I'm Neil Ferguson, Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and Chair of the Hoover History Working Group. Today we've been lucky to hear a fascinating presentation by Dr. Nils Gilman, Vice President of Programs at the Berggruen Institute. Now, we're often lucky to have historians from universities come and speak at our group, but it's actually by no means a prerequisite, and many of the best historians in the world today are not professors of history, and Nils is a good example of this. He is an academic by training, a product of Berkeley, where he did his undergraduate and PhD degrees. He was Associate Chancellor at Berkeley for a time, and then worked as Research Director and Scenario Planning Consultant at the Monitor Group and the Global Business Network. He's also worked for Salesforce and BEA Systems. Nils won the Sydney Award for long-form journalism from the New York Times and an Albee Award for international political economy from the Washington Post. He's the author of two books, Mandarins of the Future, Modernization Theory in Cold War America, and Deviant Globalization, Black Market Economy in the 21st Century, which was published in 2011. The topic of his talk today was structural adjustment as development, broadly speaking, a history of the whole notion of structural adjustment from the earliest days of post-war international finance at the time of the Marshall Plan all the way down to the most recent global financial crisis, and even looking ahead to the kind of problems that China might find itself contemplating now that it's a major international creditor. So Nils, thank you for joining us at Hoover. I wanted to kick off with a question. As you said, it's a controversial topic. Structural adjustment became a kind of term of abuse on the left in the periods of financial crisis in the 1990s and even earlier. And yet it seems to me that structural adjustment is a kind of necessary evil when a debtor country gets into economic difficulties. And you could give it a different name, but it would still amount to the same kind of thing. So give us a little sense of why that term structural adjustment became almost a term of abuse in the late 20th century.
Well, I think that there's sometimes a view of some people on the left that if a debtor gets into trouble, then the creditor should sort of say, well, I'm sorry, you can just walk away from that expense. You know, quite aside from whether we think that that's actually a moral outcome, that would sort of very quickly dry up the ability of creditors to actually give any more credit to any other potential people who might want to borrow credit, because all the capital would go away pretty quickly if one operated on those terms. But I do think that the reason why people on the left have felt that you have described structural adjustment as a form of international abuse is that the terms that were dictated to largely developing countries in the 1980s and 1990s were ones that downsized the social sector because they were trying to get the fiscal house in order for the governments that had gotten into balance of payments challenges and debt crises. And downsizing the social sector, of course, is the bete noire of the left. And so the particular terms that were imposed in the structural adjustments of the 1980s and 1990s were, you might say, almost exquisitely designed to push the political buttons on the left.
You did a surprising thing, at least some people would find it surprising. You brought into the story some major lending programs to developed economies, so that this wasn't just a story of banks in the north lending to states in the global south. Talk a little bit about the Marshall Plan as an early and very successful exercise in structural adjustment.
Right. So there's a growing, I think, understanding that the Marshall Plan can be seen, and I certainly agree with this view, as a early form of structural adjustment. Basically, what happened with the Marshall Plan, famously, $15 billion was moved from the United States to Europe to help the European economy. Typically, the way Americans like to describe the Marshall Plan is it was an act of generosity to help the Europeans rebuild. But the Europeans themselves took the whip hand in deciding exactly how they wanted to build. You might say that they wanted to build back better after the war. And the way they wanted to build back better was to ensure that the industries that were going to be rebuilt were going to be ready to be integrated across the continental trading system. So the structural adjustments that were done to the French economy, the economies in the Low Countries, the West German economy, these things were all done in order to facilitate the growth of trade and the reintegration of the European economies after the war. This, of course, empowered some groups of people within these countries. These are the people who were taking control of the programs. So Jean Monnet and other members of the financial elite in Europe were very interested in making sure that these integrations happened. And, you know, it came at the expense of certain kinds of labor groups in some of these countries. Now, of course, that was by design, and the Americans were totally accepting of that, because one of the other purposes of the Marshall Plan was clearly to, you know, keep the rise of the threat of leftism and communism in particular down. And so these structural adjustments also helped ensure that the right kind of elites would be prevailing in Western Europe.
Now, of course, this was a time in the immediate aftermath of World War II of fixed exchange rates and relatively little, almost no, cross-border capital flows that were private rather than government-led. Fast forward to the 1980s, by which time there's been significant liberalization of capital markets. And the people doing the lending around the world are banks rather than governments. Now, this is a time that we usually associate with financial crises, but it's also the beginnings of globalization. And it seems to me that there are some costs and benefits to this process. And in the end, structural adjustment programs are what happened when things went wrong, when countries borrowed to excess, were unable to sustain growth, encountered one of the various forms of financial crisis that periodically afflict such debtor countries. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of structural adjustment programs and the introduction of that language, which, of course, nobody used in the days of George Marshall.
That's right. So the key, you know, decisive turning point in the global financial history of the late 20th century is, of course, the end of the Bretton Woods system and the floating of exchange rates and the end of the gold peg for the dollar, which takes place in August 1971. It's a little bit more of a gradual process, but at that point you start to have floating exchange rates and international currency markets really take off at that point. This had been preceded by the fact that there had been a growth of what was known as the Euro-dollar market. And also the rise of OPEC in the immediate aftermath of this means there's a huge amount of capital flowing into the oil-producing countries that then gets deposited into Western banks. Those Western banks are then loaning the money out to countries across the globe. And so that's really where you start to get the debts to private banks in New York and London primarily that are lending to countries in the global South. The term global South emerges also in the 1970s to describe what had previously been known as either backwards or underdeveloped countries. So you start to have countries, you know, in Africa and Latin America that are piling up these big debts. And then when the oil price crashes and other commodity prices crash in the early 1980s, primary producing countries run into huge balance of payments problems. And the balance of payments are to private banks, largely. They're not necessarily to state-to-state loans or to the bank. It's at this point that the World Bank and the IMF, at the behest of, you know, the Treasury in the United States, backed, you know, supported politically by, you know, political leaders in the United States and also in London, start to ask those international financial institutions to bail out these countries so that the private creditors back in New York and London can get paid back. And it starts to be those Washington, D.C., IMF, World Bank institutions that are doing the adjustment process. So this term structural adjustment emerges then in the late 1970s and really takes off in the 1980s to describe the particular terms that the bank and the IMF primarily impose on debtor nations as a condition for the bailout. So those things include, as I mentioned earlier, privatization, downsizing of the social sector, so health, education, and welfare spending, privatization of state-owned enterprises, creation of independent central banks, moving towards opening up the economy to foreign direct investment, moving the structure of your economy towards export-led growth as opposed to import substitution industrialization. So there's a number of these things that emerge, and eventually by the late 1980s, this bundle of policy procedures that are meant to do the structural adjustment that will ensure that these countries do not run into future balance of payments problems comes to be known as the Washington Consensus about the right mix of policies that will ensure that these countries can continue to grow without getting into financial crises along the way.
When we look back on that period of the Washington Consensus, which I guess came to a pretty shattering end with the financial crisis of 2008, if not earlier, would we conclude as financial historians that the benefits had exceeded the costs, or would it have been better if we'd somehow stayed in that pre-1971 world of limited international capital flows? Did all the crises ultimately cost more than the growth that was generated between the crises or in the countries that didn't have crises? Can we come to a conclusion about the Washington Consensus or what is sometimes called disparagingly neoliberalism with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, I think it's hard to answer that question because it's the macro historical question of the late 20th century, and it's a grand counterfactual. Here's why I'm skeptical about the counterfactual, though, because a huge part of the driver of the move into this world of floating exchange rates and hot capital is driven by technological change that then affects the financial sector. So specifically, the crucially important things that happen are the rise of computing, the application of computing to financial services. That allows bankers and banks to become much, much bigger and allows international trade of financial services to move capital all over the world. Now, I think that fundamentally moving capital to where there's demand for capital turbocharges growth. To me, the problem that neoliberalism has produced is not that it's been bad on a macro level. It's produced vast amounts of wealth. The problem is that the way that that wealth has been distributed has created all sorts of political problems, both globally and inside many countries. So the fruits of that growth has not been evenly distributed anywhere close. It's been largely gone to elites in these different countries. Now, there are exceptions. There's been a huge growth of a middle class in China. There's beginning to be a much bigger middle class in Latin America, even in Africa. But the truth is that of the amount of growth that neoliberalism has produced outside of China, the main beneficiaries have been, if not the top 1%, maybe the top 10% in many of these countries, right? So you look at India, for example. The growth that India has experienced over the last 20 years in the wake of doing its own structural adjustments has been very large, but it's basically accrued primarily to, a fairly small elite at the top of the Indian hierarchy. And today in India, it's a much richer country than it was, but it still has more malnourished and stunted children than all of sub-Saharan Africa, right? So the growth and the benefit of that growth has not been as evenly distributed as I think many of us would like.
And Nils, you mentioned China, and China, of course, was the recipient of very large amounts of foreign investment and produced the most spectacular industrial revolution and the most extraordinary bout of economic growth in economic history. And yet there wasn't a financial crisis in the Chinese case that necessitated the IMF's intervention or a structural adjustment program. Is China the exception that proves the rule? And if so, what did they do differently?
So I think China is just an exception altogether. And the reason why it's an exception is just because it's so big. It was able, because of the size of the market, and you know, I sometimes think that the way bankers in the West have looked at China and businessmen in general, it's like, you know, those cartoons where you see the eyes get really big and there's dollar signs in them. That's the way business people have looked at China, well, since the 19th century, frankly. Right. Westerners have looked at the size of that market and said, if we can get into that market, my God, think of the money we can make, right? And I think that that abiding fantasy has been there, as I say, goes back, you know, into the 19th century. What that means is that China has been able to, in this most recent period, since the liberal reforms, the reform and opening up process that began under Deng Xiaoping in the late 1970s, to control the way in which all that capital came into the country. They didn't allow super hot capital. If you wanted to invest in China, you had to do joint ventures. The investments had to be in ways that prevented hot flows. They would have been very strategic about making sure, while they wanted a lot of capital and lots of people were willing to put capital into China because of the opportunities that are there, the Chinese maintained much more control than a smaller country would have been able to dictate terms for, just because of sheer, you know, scale and size. So that's the first thing. China had advantages that no other country had in terms of being able to control the way in which the foreign investments went into them, because their heft gave them leverage, negotiating leverage. The second thing is, the Chinese, I think, have looked at the way in which structural adjustment episodes unfolded in the 1980s and 1990s, and perhaps most decisively during the Asian financial crisis of 1997, where the IMF came in and the Asian countries had experienced a hot money outflow that led to a balance of payments crisis. And in the need for a bailout, the IMF came in and demanded all sorts of structural changes, including the dethroning of certain kinds of political influence in countries like Thailand and Indonesia and South Korea. Well, you know, the Chinese in the 1990s are engaged in their own internal structural reform process as they're getting ready to enter the WTO in 2001. And they look at what happens in Asia in 1997 and 1998, and they say, we don't want to ever have that happen to us. Their whole ideology for the last, you know, since Mao came to power in 1949, won the Civil War and won the revolution, was they were never going to allow the West to dictate terms to them again, to impose what the Chinese call unfair treaties, unequal treaties against them. And so they looked at what happened in 1997 and 1998 in East Asia, and they said, when we go into the WTO, we're going to make sure that we control the currency. We're going to do financial repression at home. We're going to not have too much consumption going on at home. We're going to have run consistent trade surpluses. We're going to run consistent balance of payment surpluses. That way, if there is a financial crisis, as would in fact eventually unfold just 6 or 7 years later with the global financial crisis, they would not be in a position where Westerners would be able to come in and tell them how they had to adjust their economy and that the Chinese Communist Party was going to have to decrease its level of control. So I think the Chinese have learned from the history of structural adjustment specific political economy lessons about the way they want to manage the way in which they integrate with the global economy. And I'll leave you with one final thought on that point. You know, there's a lot of discussions, and I know you've talked about this a lot, Neil, about whether the Chinese have ambitions to have the renminbi replace the dollar as the US, as the global reserve currency. I'm skeptical that the Chinese are going to want to, well, I think they want to do that, but I'm skeptical they're going to, because if you want to be the global reserve currency, you have to have an open currency, current account. There's no other way to do it. And if you do that, then you cannot, by definition, have total control over the relationship between your internal domestic economy and global financial flows. You have to give up that level of political control. And I don't think they want to do that. I really think that their primary motive is about domestic political control, and that militates against the idea that the renminbi could ever be a global reserve currency.
Well, Nils, I think I'm inclined to agree with that analysis. Of course, what goes around comes around. The Chinese now find themselves the largest creditor to developing economies in the world. And with the events of 2020, there are clearly going to be defaults on the part of at least some of those borrowers. So structural adjustment may become part of the Chinese Communist Party's vocabulary as it comes to deal with its own debtors in the coming months and years. Nils, thanks so much for this fascinating overview of the history of structural adjustment and the changing patterns of international financial flows. It's been a real pleasure to have you at the Hoover History Working Group. And we look forward to reading more about this when you publish at some future date your findings. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.